Hey there, Brainiacs. Welcome to the Beaker Report podcast, the science show for the average Joe. I'm your host, Steve Burke.
And I'm Caleb Schuler.
Sit back and enjoy the show.
Prepare to get your minds blown. Or not.
Yeah, probably not. No, but really, prepare. And we're back.
That's it. The intro.
The Beaker Report podcast. Doop,
doop. Oh,
that's still the only only sound effect I got loaded up. I need to expand my soundboard someday.
Yeah, but I like that one, so we can just keep that one. And
yeah, that's the best.
I mean,
one.
We never use any. So
I know.
I guess it doesn't really matter.
I was like, I remember when I got the soundboard, I was like, oh, I'm so excited. I'm going to make all these little sound clips. It's going to be awesome. But yeah, I mean, I just never had
I don't even think about it.
With it.
The only time I remember trying to use sounds was when we did the UFC one, and we kept trying to pull up like the bell.
The bell.
And it was always late.
Yeah.
Not even close.
That's the other thing, too. Like, I need to get a dedicated, like, soundboard somehow. Like my iPad always, or I could just turn off the lock on my iPad, but my iPad always goes to sleep. And then when we get to the end of the episode, I always miss the spaceship landing.
I always forget about it until like I turn off the recording and we're just kind of chilling, and then 5 seconds later I hear the spaceship. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right.
Oh man. But yeah, so we're back. It's early on a Saturday.
It's a Saturday morning. If I was about 8 to 10, maybe even 13 years old, back in the day, I'd be watching X-Men or Spider-Man right now, I think.
That's right. Yeah. What was that channel called that had all those on there?
I used to watch it on like Fox Kids or something in the morning.
Yeah, it was something like that, yeah.
But I know
they would have like Spider-Man on.
Dude,
that was like the best.
Dude, X-Men cartoons were the best. Do 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 do. That's the intro song.
I think we talked about X-Men before, but who was your favorite X-Men?
Oh, I always liked Wolverine and Cyclops, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, those are pretty much everybody's favorite.
I feel like my brother was like into Gambit. I'm like, who are you, dude?
Yeah, no Gambit was cool because he had the card.
Yeah, and like
he could
a
throw
bow staff
cards and stuff.
And just hit
people
in the head with it.
But he definitely wasn't the best.
No, everyone loved Wolverine, and Cyclops was cool because he was like, I don't know, man. He was just like the goody two shoes of the bunch.
And then Wolverine was the opposite. Cool power.
Yeah, he was shooting lasers out of his eyeballs, man. That's pretty sick.
Yeah, that's pretty sweet. Yeah. But Wolverine's powers are pretty cool, too. I mean, he's got like metal bones and like.
Yeah,
like
he heals up pretty
quick. Swords that comes out of his hands. Yeah, he's pretty much indestructible.
Dude, did you ever see the last Wolverine movie that came out? When he's with the little kid?
He's like Logan?
Yeah, yeah.
I saw it, but it's been a minute, so I can't say I remember all of it. But I remember it being pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty gnarly. I think he was like, that was the first one they showed him like killing people.
Yeah. And the little girl with her tiny little Wolverine blades. Like
she was
messing
going,
people up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just remember like, although he's still like super shredded, like that was the one where Hugh Jackman was like starting to show some aging.
Yeah.
I
think that was the point of it though, in general. It was like his powers weren't, I don't even remember the plot of why his powers and stuff stopped working, but like he had like cancer or something. I don't know. Like he was just dying.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of weird, but yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I just want to know what cocktail those, like when you get that much money and you're an actor, like Hugh Jackman and like, what's another good example? The Rocky dude. Why can't I think of his name right now?
Sylvester Stallone. Yeah.
Like those dudes are like getting up there in age, but they're still just jacked and shredded.
Dude. I remember when I used to think that they weren't using steroids. That was the good old days when I was naive and stuff. I was like, dang, Or like in the movie 300 before I realized they were on steroids and then they airbrushed abs on them and shit. I was like,
oh yeah, that's that one's hilarious.
I'm like, what?
Well, there was like a parody of that, wasn't there, on something. I forget what I was watching, but they like did like clear blatant like ab painting. It looked awful. It's like they're just ripping on 300.
Dude, I love that movie though. I remember like, oh, I'll do the Spartan workout, like that'd be sweet. And then I realized like the guys even that did the movie didn't even do the Spartan workout. Like, what is going on? This bullshit, dude.
No. And yeah, I mean, you look at what's that guy's name, the actor, main actor?
Gerard Butler.
Yeah, Gerard Butler.
He's fat.
Yeah, I mean, he's just got a beer belly now.
Dude, he did it right, man. He was like, I'll kind of get in shape. You guys can make me look cooler than I am. And then I'll just pick up all the ladies and make a ton of money. All right.
Yeah.
And I'll get fat.
And then he'll see you later.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. They all kind of get like that a little bit. Like, you see like pics of Leonardo DiCaprio and stuff in his off time. And he's just like... he's just like ballooning it up.
Dude,
a little
why
bit.
Why not? I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I like working out, but I also don't want to be. I don't know. I was thinking about this the other day because I was in the gym in the morning and there's like a bunch of like old, like I don't know how old, like 40 something, maybe 50 something dudes in there, like wearing tight shirts and like in front of the mirrors doing like bicep curls. And I was like, man, how annoying is that? Shit, I don't even know where this story was going to go.
I don't know.
But like at some point, like you just have to be like, ah, this is what I am. Like, I don't like,
yeah.
Why do I need to get jacked anymore? Like, who cares?
Yeah. I think to get jacked just for the sake of having bulging muscles and looking like awesome.
Yeah.
It's kind of silly. Like, I think it's good to work out to the extent that you're healthy and to like ward off against like disease and dying and stuff like that.
And terrorists. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I've never wanted to just like get, what do they say, swole.
Oh, dude, I did. I did for so long.
For the purpose. Yeah.
When I was in the Navy, when I deployed, that's all I did. Just work out.
I always thought it looked kind of funny, like the guys who just get so jacked that they can barely move and stuff. It's like, what do you want to do that for?
Dude, like, I had a bunch of friends like that. I'm like, you gotta have at least some functionality to what you're doing here, man. Like, I get it, you want to be like a giant Hulk like dude, but I can just like kick you and then run away. It's not that tough.
Yeah, that's like, I got a Jeep, so I've been like looking into Jeeps and modifying it, and like there's countless videos on the internet, but you like you run across that video every now and then of a guy, he's like, I'm gonna try and fit 38s on this Jeep without a lift. And like they like cram the tires on there, and it's like there's like a millimeter of space between the tire and the fender, and it's like, why, like, what are you gonna do with all that tire on there now? Your suspension can't move at all. Can't go over a bump or it's gonna ruin everything. Like,
at least it looks sweet though.
Yeah, people are hilarious. That's, they all just matters. Care about what
gotta look cool.
Yeah,
I so, wish I could get into that cars and stuff, but I just don't care. I'm just like, man.
Yeah, I don't know. I've just been doing it since I was little. Like, I always worked on my car or my dad's car with him.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know. I've always just loved tearing stuff apart and working on stuff. What I've been looking into lately, the main reason I've been looking into Jeep stuff, I've always thought it would be awesome to take a Jeep and convert it to an electric car.
Oh, yeah.
Like an old Jeep. Like, I have a 2005 TJ, and I would even like to go farther back. So there's like, you can identify the year of Jeep by like the two letter name. So they have like CJ is where it started, stands for civilian Jeep. So they were based on the flat fender,
like the
Willie
Jeeps
from the World War II. After that, they came out with another model called the CJ.
Yeah.
That was like 70s to 80s ish, and that was called the civilian Jeep. And then they go to the YJ, I think, after that, and then you get to the TJ, and then the newer one is the JK, and they just came out with the JL. So they kind of every like 10 years or so, they'd do a new body style and update the Jeep and all that.
Yeah.
But the CJ would be a pretty cool one to do a conversion because it's just bare bones, like old school Jeep.
Yeah, it's sweet looking. I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah. It's got the round lights. So there's the TJ and all the new Jeeps have round lights and the CJ.
Can you see that?
But they, oh yeah, that's perfect. That's exactly it. Yeah, exactly. So there, but in the not the 90s, in the like 80s to 90s, there was the YJ. That one had square lights, and I think that one's kind of, that's lame. What, there's no Jeeps with square lights.
Yeah, it's stupid.
I like except for like Cherokees and stuff like that. But
you should totally get the Willy one though. This World War II one. Yeah. That's dope.
Yeah, so there's people that get those. There's the actual Willy World War II ones, and they have like flat fenders on them. Yeah, so they call those the flat fender.
That's awesome.
And yeah, there's guys that like have redone those so they're exactly like they were during the war.
Could mount, and some of them 50 like 50 cal on the back.
Yeah, some of them do like just like a replica one just to have it back there.
A broomstick.
But yeah, so I've been looking into it. I always thought it would be cool to make my own electric car.
That sounds tough, but you work with electric stuff, so it might not be that bad for you.
Why not? I put 9 volts in series all the time. What would go wrong with putting 12 volts in series?
It's just a little bit bigger. What could go wrong?
Yeah. But yeah, so I thought that'd be cool, and I started looking into it. And I also thought it would be one of the first Jeeps to be electric, but it turns out there's a ton of them out there. People do it all the time. So I was kind of bummed about that.
Yeah,
but
you're never the first on anything, dude.
Yeah.
Just never.
It's actually, well, and actually when cars first came out, that's what they were running on, was electric. A lot of the early cars back in like the 1800s or whatever, they were electric. Yeah, so electric cars are nothing new. The problem was the battery technology and then mileage range and stuff like that. So they were like, they were just made, in fact, they were called carriages because they were electric carriages because they were replacing horse carriages.
When was the first battery? Oh, no, that's a bad question. Never mind. Go ahead.
What?
When was the first battery made? Because I know they found some stuff like in Egypt and shit. They're like, this is the first battery ever. Yeah. I'm like, well, that doesn't count. But yeah, I don't know when the first like actual batteries were made. But is that what you mean? Like electric, were they running off of batteries or were they running off of like...
Yeah. Yeah, they were full-on electric cars running off a battery.
Damn.
So Volta, I was wrong. It wasn't Galvani. It was Volta.
Of course.
In 1800, pretty much exactly, he built the first modern-day battery.
Nice.
But yeah, so where was it going with that?
Oh. your carriages were made out of
so it's not new, the idea of the electric car. It's actually fascinating to look. I love the history of cars, but there was if you go back, so one of my favorite channels on YouTube is Jay Leno's Garage.
Yeah.
He has an amazing car show online. And one of the greatest collections of cars in this country, or probably even in the world. It's crazy.
Yeah, he has like a bunch of warehouses full of cars, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. And just his knowledge. And it's not like he's just some rich dude that like bought all these cars. Yeah. Like he's immersed in the history of cars and like he reads all of anything he can read about the history of cars, he does. Like, and he'll get all the paperwork when he buys a car and like the maintenance guides. Dang. And like looks into the club for that car or whatever, because every like car that's collectible usually has some sort of like club that you can join, and there's other people that are into that car and stuff like that. But one of my favorite videos that he has on there is when he has on his steam-powered cars. Before I watched his show at all, I had no idea there were even steam-powered cars. But it's pretty cool. They have like a water tank underneath with a boiler. Hmm. And like before you take off, you like fill it up. And then this thing just heats the water up and creates steam. And then the car runs off of steam. But like the craftsmanship on these cars back in the day was like insane. Like the inside of the car and like how they, like the fabric on the seats and like the hand carved wood on the dashes and stuff like that. It was like, it was incredible. But those are some of my favorite cars to learn about. If you go on his channel, he's got countless steam powered cars. But and it's cool, like on the front they've got like the hand crank start and stuff. But yeah, yeah. So I've been looking into a bunch of car videos and trying to learn how to convert a car into electric, and it's actually amazing. Like how easy it is. Well, it's not, you kind of have to know a little bit, but they're definitely making it easier, and there's a whole lot of companies out there now that make like bolt-on conversions for like used cars.
Really?
Yeah, so that's one thing that can we talked about before. We've talked about like global warming and needing to transition to some renewable energy source, and like one of the problems would be everybody having to go out and buy a brand new car, and how that wouldn't be easily attainable for most people. But I was looking into it. A lot of these cars have an achievable range on them that like would be fine for most people in their daily driving. And you like still have your heat and your air and everything like that, and you can do that for like right around $12,000. And that sounds like a lot. It sounds like a big initial upfront investment. But that's having them install it. You could install it yourself and do it cheaper, but if you need someone to do it, you're not mechanically inclined. That's to have a place that's good at doing this, do that. And if you look at it, the cost savings from, for one, you completely take your motor out. So you don't have an engine anymore, and there's a whole bunch of battery packs that replace it. And then you have an electric motor, and electric motors are way more reliable than a like a mechanical gas-powered motor like that you run your car on. Yeah, so it's just like one moving part, so there's not a whole lot to go wrong. So one, you're not going to be replacing parts on your motor. You're not going to be doing oil changes. You're not going to be replacing air filters. All the maintenance associated with your car, you're not going to be doing that. And they did the calculation just on the oil changes alone. If you do your oil change every like 5,000 miles or whatever, it pretty much pays for like half the components just in oil changes. And that's not including gas savings and all that stuff. So they said total cost installed, it pays for itself within the first 4 years of owning the electric car. So it's actually fairly reasonable already, and just imagine in 10 years with the progress we're going to make in technology and stuff like that. It's not like you have to go out and buy a brand new Tesla. You could potentially convert an old car, or I'm sure there's going to be other options and cheaper versions of cars too coming out. If someone wants to buy a car.
If the government really cared about the issue, then they could make it like some type of like tax deductible thing, right? Like you convert your car and you get that money back, or a portion of it or something.
But they won't. And it would start getting even more. At least not anytime soon. So it's pretty cool. There's a big difference though, and I'm still kind of learning about like what are the different options. But I've seen some Jeeps that have like over 100 miles range.
Then
I've seen others that only have like 40 or 50 miles range. So I don't know what this group's doing different than the other group, because I wouldn't want 40, 50 miles. I think I could conceivably justify having a car that has like 100 miles range. I don't really drive that far anyway in my car.
I drive like 3 miles a day.
But I would like to be able to like go on a little trip and come back and not have to worry. I don't need to drive across the country. If I do, then I could either take Joey's car or you know, we could figure something out with that. But,
right.
But yeah, I mean, so that's something I'm looking into doing in the future. But as far as the government caring, did you see the Rogan episode with Andrew Yang?
Yes, that was pretty enlightening. Really, it was strange. Yeah. I never really considered all the different things he was bringing up about like people losing their jobs and whatever. But one thing I did think of. Okay, so I guess the Andrew Yang episode was I don't know his exact title, but he's a candidate running for president.
Right. Yeah.
He has this background in entrepreneurship and kind of like trying to increase employment in different areas. So he was kind of on this leading front of, hey, like soon AI and robotics are going to take over a lot of the majority of the jobs, like truck drivers, like both of our parents do or whatever, you know, like these jobs that a lot of middle-class America has done forever. And it's going to leave these guys without and girls, whatever, without, jobs. And so he's pushing
like the top jobs that we're talking about is, like you said, truck driving, retail, like in cashiers and stuff.
I don't like cashiers anyway, so that's fine.
Yeah, he said call centers, and the other big thing is like manufacturing and warehouse work and stuff like that.
And that's already going.
That and that's already like millions of jobs. I forget how many millions of truck drivers he said there were, and millions of call center people. But it's a lot.
I think
of,
it was like
of people
30 to 40% of jobs in America, or something like that. Something crazy, like a big chunk. But yeah, it's already happening. And what he kind of equated it to like a baseball game. He said we're already in the third inning of the game.
Right.
No one's doing a thing.
Which I was like, oh my God, we're right at the end. But then I realized there's nine innings.
No, dude, there's nine. There's nine. We're only a third way in. Oh my God, we're gonna die.
We're in the third quarter. Oh wait, no, there's nine innings.
He's pushing like so to deal with this kind of change. He's kind of thinking of how to I guess deal with the layoff of workers, and one of the ways he's thinking about doing it is by doing this universal income thing, which it sounds good.
I think as an American, any American, they hear that and they're like, oh my God, like we have this like complete aversion to that, because we're like in America, we're all about the free market and capitalism and starting a business and letting the market determine value for things and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But he made some really good points as to just some realities when you're talking about replacing all of those jobs. Yeah. You know, typically people would be like, oh, just retrain these people and they'll find another job, or with those jobs that we will replace, we're going to create other jobs to manage those jobs. But the problem is a lot of those people don't really have the skills for those new jobs if you do create the jobs.
Right.
And two, it's not going to be one for one. You're not going to take one job and create another. It's probably going to be more like 20 to 1 or something like that. You're going to take 20 jobs and maybe create one oversight job, or 100 jobs and create one position to oversee those jobs you took or whatever.
Yeah, it's going to be a pretty big displacement. And then, I mean, it's not as simple as like retrain people, because people do, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why people get into their jobs. Like maybe they just needed money at the time. Maybe they do care. Maybe they do want to do another job, but maybe they just don't want, they don't like school and they don't want to go learn how to do coding.
Yeah,
or
they just
like
aren't
that.
Capable.
Yeah.
I mean, think about your average 40-year-old guy who's driving a truck.
Oh, I don't know. They don't want to do that.
He's never going to go and become a coder.
No,
like,
there's no
and
way.
And he's not going to be as efficient or as good as someone who's passionate about it, who's young, who went straight into that. It's going to be a nightmare. And he made a great point. Like, if you look at some studies that show, like, and assess how good we are at retraining someone for new jobs, like, we're pretty awful at it.
Yeah, it was pretty
abysmal.
According
to the data.
Yeah, it was like, I can't remember the numbers, but it was just like, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
One thing that like I thought about during that podcast was like, so obviously Dayton, Ohio, whenever all the, what was it, GM? Was GM in Ohio and Dayton? Whatever. Yeah. When they all left.
Yeah, the GM plant.
He connected these these companies, when they left out and went to Mexico or whatever, closed down all their warehouses to the opioid problem.
Oh, yeah.
And I never connected the two, but that makes a lot of sense. Because you think about Dayton, Ohio is like pretty high up on the list of like opioid epidemic or whatever problems.
Oh, yeah. We're up there.
And suicide rates and stuff like that within within the population when they lose jobs. And I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know. Okay, so I like he wants to give everyone $1,000, which will help a month or whatever.
Yeah.
But if you're making 70, 50, whatever, thousand a year, like I don't know how much having an extra 12 grand a year. I guess it'll help you meet. That's the idea. Meet the basics of like maybe help you pay rent or whatever.
It's a fallback plan.
Yeah.
And I don't think his point is to totally, like, you're not supposed to just, like,
live off of it, right?
Lose your job and live off of it. But it's a way to, if you do lose your job, you're not just out of luck and have nothing.
Yeah.
And then, since you have that, it will, like, it will help start new like enterprises or new jobs. People can go out there and start trying to create something new instead of having to like train for something that they're not like cut out for or they're not going to be able to do. So yeah, I mean it's not $1,000. Like that's my thing. Like it's like also for like people like single mothers who are taking care of four people on that $1,000 a month. Like that's not gonna be anywhere close. And I was also, there's definitely some small detail questions I have about it. I think he's right that we need to, this is going to be a huge problem and we're going to have to address it in some way. And I think it's a good start to, it's a good going in the right direction.
Yeah.
But there's definitely some small detail questions. Like currently there's people on like social welfare or like social security or disability or something like that. And I don't know, like, are you going to just replace those services with $1,000 a month? Or if those people get that, do they also get an extra $1,000 a month? Like, how does this, there's like little things like that.
I think he mentioned that. I think he said like, if you're already on some type of program, you, if you're already making more than whatever, $1,000 off that program, you won't get any more. And if you're making under that, they split the difference
then you add the
and
difference.
To get you up to $1,000 or something like that. But I'm not 100%.
The one thing I do, the one thing I do agree with though is that it would probably lower certain crimes.
Oh, for sure.
Like for instance, anybody in jail right now for drug related crimes, like there's some people that are in jail just for drug possession. I don't know if it would lower that unless we decriminalize, and I think we've addressed that before. But like people are in jail for like theft crimes related to using drugs. So there's a lot of people who use drugs, they lose their job, and then they don't have money to continue getting their drugs. So then they go and steal to try and get money to get their drugs. If they have $1,000 a month,
they're not stealing.
Then you never run into that problem. And then it's like, you know, you, then you get the argument, oh, but then there's going to be all these lazy people using drugs. Well, first of all,
they're already there.
As they're already there. There's increasing numbers of them because of displaced workers and things like that. And then when you criminalize those people and put them in jail, you're spending way more money than $1,000 a month to keep them in jail. We're not efficient at jailing, so it's really expensive, and it's actually, so you'd actually, you're spending money up front, but you might actually be saving money in the end, because those people won't end up being in jail, maybe.
That's, that was one of his points. He said he talked to, like, I don't know, you know, it's very anecdotal or whatever, but he talked to a guy that works in a prison. He said, you know, we should start paying people to stay out of jail because it'll be cheaper.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, but there are some issues with that. Like, there's some people who, you could pay them all day, and they're still going to do awful things. But there's still, like he said, there's still going to be jails. People are still going to be in jail. We're not taking jails away, but it will help keep some of those people who shouldn't be there out because they're able to, meet basic needs. And I like his point. Like, if you have $1,000 to, like, some people would like to take a risk and start a business, mm-hmm. or try and do something creative for a living. But because there's nothing to fall back on, or they may have to, like, go into debt, and it's not certain that if right. they go in this field that they're going to have any income on the other side, then they just keep working some job that they don't want to be in. So something like this could spur some of that job creation or business creation or something like that, because people have that lifeline right. to fall back on.
I would be curious. I mean, I understand he had this point, like, you know, people, we give them the money, and that money ends up going back into the tax system because people will spend the money, mm-hmm. they'll buy shit on Amazon, they'll go to out to eat, they'll go see movies, so it all recycles back in. But I'd be curious if everyone got, you know, whatever, working age, 18 to whatever, 65 or something, I don't remember the ages, but if everyone got $1,000, yeah. would that cause some sort of inflation within the system? You know what I mean? Like, is that just going to bump up everything, the prices, and then basically you're
I think it ultimately depends on how you're funding that $1,000 a month. If the government's just printing money to do it, then yeah, that causes inflation. But if you're taking it from other places, like tax revenue, or mm-hmm. like he said, some of these top, if you do some kind of tax charge on the top tech companies that are making hundreds of billions a year by taking a lot of these jobs, then
yeah,
I don't think so, because then it's real money that's in the system.
It's just being like moved recycling around.
Yeah. So like I said, it just depends on how they pay for that. But yeah, it's a really interesting concept. I think it's a question that I was similar, to a lot of people, where you hear it and you just have this immediate, like, aversion to it. You're like, nah, that can't work. And we've got this idea that, like, people are inherently lazy, and so if they don't have to work and try hard for things, then you're just going to have a bunch of people sitting around, things like that. But there's real issues with increasing technology and automation and stuff like that that are just going to hit us. And like he said, you can try and time it out and do it when it really is necessary, and maybe be too late
yeah.
to do it, or you can just already start trying to address the problem.
You
got
to start preparing for it, right?
Yeah. So it's pretty interesting. I don't know if he's got all of the right answers for it, but he's definitely thought it out way more than,
oh, yeah.
than most people have, and he seems like a pretty smart guy. I don't know a lot about his other policies and ideas on things.
That's what I would be interested in. I think he's calling himself a Democrat so he can at least be
yeah.
in the debates, but I don't know what his actual views on stuff are,
right.
but I mean, he seems smart enough and
yeah. And I'm happy to hear that he's running in one of the parties, because that's one of the problems is when you yeah. get a promising candidate like that and then they go independent, nobody's voting for those parties. And then
I voted for a third party last time.
I did too, but that's there's two sides of the coin. One, mm-hmm. you know, kind of that you're throwing your vote away because they don't really have a chance,
right?
But you also have this idea, like, if somebody is really a promising candidate and a lot of people like their views and ideas, then you should vote for that, because if everybody just thinks, oh, it's a waste, then you're never gonna yeah. it's always gonna be the case. So I don't like
that's how they lock
that
you
idea
in.
Yeah, I don't like that idea of not doing it because you might waste your vote.
Yeah.
But it is kind of true a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It is true, but it sucks. But
yeah,
it's true.
And it's hard, like you said, if you're not in one of those parties, there's no ability for you to be in the debates. There's mm-hmm. no ability for you to get noticed on the national level for people to actually, you know about you or be interested
in you.
So
the weirdest part of that podcast was when they started talking about, is it the Iowa caucus or something, where you need you just need like 40,000 people in Iowa to think you're good, and then you're
yeah.
in the conversation and debates.
Yeah.
I'm like, how is that even a system anymore? Like, yeah. why Iowa anymore? Like, just pull everybody.
Yeah.
Whatever. I have no idea, man.
Well, the thing is, so that's why there's the caucus, right? So you have the population, but there's only a certain amount of those people who actually participate.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
In the voting. So that's the caucus then. And then there's a certain number in the percentage of people who actually will go vote, and you just need the majority. So, right. Like, you can do that with every state. Like, how many people in this state do I actually need to go to the next thing? It is pretty interesting. I've never really broken it down like that and thought about that. But it is something I'd like to look into more. And I've talked about that with Joey. So
you're going to run for Senate.
No. this year, or not this year, but this cycle, I guess, presidential cycle.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of problems, right? You know, Donald Trump, there's a lot of craziness.
What? Everything's perfect, dude.
But the one positive thing that has come out of it, well, you could look at it from two ways. Maybe it's positive, maybe it's not. But the one positive thing, in my opinion, that's come out of this is how many people now are focusing on the political process and being involved and, like, paying attention to it and, like, realizing, oh, it is important for me to, like, go out there and vote and, like, figure this stuff out, because there's real serious ramifications if you don't participate in that process and blah, 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 blah. Right. So I think that's one thing definitely that Donald Trump has done is stirred up a lot of interest in politics and getting people involved and stuff like that. There's a whole lot of other things that have stirred up. Dude, and a whole lot of divisiveness within the country that's not great.
That's the Russians' fault. I'm blaming the Russians, man.
Yeah, you were telling me about that podcast you listened to. I still haven't gotten a chance to check it out, but it sounds interesting.
It's good. It's interesting. Yeah, so just check that one out. That's a Sam Harris. I forget the woman that was on there, but it's all about how the Russians, it's not even hacked, but how the Russians influenced ideologues within this tribal.
Yeah, because they don't have to hack, right? They just
no, because Americans are so
social
stupid.
Media accounts.
Yeah. You just get on there and start posting what people want, and it separates
and then
everyone.
They just stir up conversation, and then people, like, get mad at the other side and then create all this divisiveness.
Yeah. It works.
Yeah. It's interesting. But yeah, so maybe for the folks out there listening, keep your eye on Andrew Yang. He sounds promising. Like I said, I don't know a lot about his other ideas on policies. I definitely got to look into him more.
Right.
But he sounds pretty reasonable. I'd really be interested in hearing what he thinks about global warming and climate change and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And a number of his other issues, but the main thing with the basic income, I still think like because I believe he did say it's like an opt in opt out thing, and if you have a job that you still get your $1,000 a month. So that's why I go back to like those social programs where you. Like Social Security or anything like that. Like, why would they not get that and get a chunk taken out of their $1,000 a month? Like, I would think it should just be
like added
like a
on.
Stimulus.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but there's not a lot sure of details either. To work out with that, but it's an interesting question.
There's another, what's the guy that, he was the former CEO of Starbucks. He's talking about running. I don't know any of his ideas either, but it'd be anyone that's not like within the system that's talking about running. I'm a little bit interested in at least to hear what they have to say. But that's what Trump
Me too.
Did. So Trump.
I'm gonna actually. So I like wasted time last year and I missed the primary vote.
Oh yeah.
So I only got to vote on the final part. But this time I want to like actually like keep track of it all and like figure out who I'm interested in and like vote in the primary.
Well, in Ohio last year, John Kasich won the primary over Trump.
Oh.
So.
Yeah.
Didn't matter.
Yeah. At least it got him to the next level, right?
Yeah.
Because if you don't win anything in the primary, then you're
you're
kind of dead in the water. So.
We'll see. It's interesting. I like to follow it. I don't know. I don't want to get too deep into it. I don't want to be the guy on like Twitter, like talking shit about politics, because I hate that.
Yeah.
But it is interesting to follow along and at least kind of know a bit and not force yourself into one sphere. Like,
yeah.
Know the big picture, not just what the people on the left are saying or what the people on the right are saying. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's the craziest thing to me is like, I am a Democrat 100% every single time, no matter who's running, and that's what I vote for. Like, that's the craziest.
You're all right, dude. You're all right.
Yeah. But that's like the craziest idea to me is like every single round you're going to be in the same camp.
Oh,
like,
dude, that's just how people, I mean, it's, and I get it because it's hard, especially for like local elections, right? Like there's no way you know what the hell is going on with all these people that are running. So you just go in, if you do vote, you go into the booth and you're like, which one has the D or the R next to their name? And you're just like, click, 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 click. All right. Yeah. Well, see you later.
Yeah. But that's so, like, I don't know. I feel like if you don't know, don't vote for that thing.
I just vote for if I don't know, I just pick the independent person. I'm like, all right,
yeah.
Hopefully you're not an idiot. I don't know.
Yeah, but that's one interesting thing that he also mentioned on that podcast was like how we used to have all these local papers that were supported by classified ads. Did you hear him talking about
that? I didn't I think I had like 30 minutes still to go on that, so I don't remember that part.
So he had mentioned, like, there used to be, like, in every little town, and I remember reading some of these, but there was, like these smaller postings? Local papers that had, like, what was going on in the community.
Yeah.
But,
oh,
like,
yeah.
They paid for the printing and all of the, like, you know, people working there to keep the thing going and make it or whatever through selling classified ads. So like, you know, job postings or
cars
like
cars and things,
garage sales or anything. And now like things like Craigslist have totally replaced that, or the Facebook Marketplace or whatever. And he was saying one problem is now nobody really knows what's going on locally. Like we focus so much on national, news and stuff like that, but we really have no idea, I guess maybe unless you're like a local business guy and you really dig into it or something like that, but you don't, the general person in the community doesn't know anymore politically or anything like that what's going on. And that kind of creates some issues,
all the newspapers are gone anyways. Like I mean, I'm sure you've seen like the Dayton Daily News building that used to be on 75 is like up for sale. They're like, we can't afford this shit anymore.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So, and I mean, I get why. I mean, everyone just finds their news on Facebook and Twitter now, which is part of the problem anyways. But, and plus, no
that
one
was
believes
another
the news.
Thing.
So, it's the weird.
That was another. Yeah, nobody believes it. That it is hard to know where to trust, like what sources to trust, because you're like, oh, if I'm reading Fox, they're going to say everything great about Trump. Mm-hmm. If I'm reading CNN, it's everything bad about Trump.
Right,
and it's like, you don't feel like you're actually getting informed, you're just hearing the opinions of each side,
right?
Stupid. So that's tough. But that was one thing he also talked about was the automation of news outlets. And I just read an article online about Elon Musk said that some company, I don't know if it was one of his companies or another company, created this word generator that was too good that they can't release it. I'll look this up.
What? That sounds insane. What does that even mean?
Yeah, so new AI fake text generator. Let's see. Maybe too dangerous to release. I guess it's a non-profit company called OpenAI. And Elon Musk, I guess, funds it in some way.
Of course he does.
But they declined to release the research publicly for fear of misuse. But they so this is an article that says the creators of a revolutionary AI system that can write news stories and works of fiction Fiction, dubbed Deep Fakes for Text, have taken an unusual step of not releasing their research publicly for fear of potential misuse. The nonprofit research company backed by Elon Musk says its new AI model called GPT-2 is so good and the risk of malicious use is so high that it is breaking from its normal practice of releasing the full research to the public in order to allow more time to discuss the ramifications of the technological breakthrough. But I guess this thing like can write fiction on its own. It can write news articles.
Oh, dude,
like,
yeah. If that thing was released, a complete AI. At least now you have to have people fake news. But if you have AI faking everything, then you're definitely screwed.
Yeah. Dude, we live in one of the craziest times. Like,
yeah,
it's so
it
wild.
Almost makes me like I want to remove myself from like social media and from watching the news so bad, but I just can't because I want to know what's going on. But I feel like the less I knew, the better off I would probably be. But
it's crazy. We're almost creating a whole new life form.
Oh,
like in real time, and like. Nobody really thinks about it. I think the people who are doing it think about it, but that's a small group of people compared to all the people in the world.
That's how it's going. And I guess we could segue into this rover talk. What's this Opportunity rover that died on Mars? But that's what
I was gonna remind you of
that's
that.
What like people are talking about. I mean, this thing was sent out and I don't know. It's been out there for 15 years. So what year is that? I don't know. But it's been sending messages and doing research or whatever.
2006.
Yeah. And people, sure,
something like that.
I don't think that math is right at all. But
I think it was close. How many years you said it was
15.
Out there?
15.
15. So yeah, it's 2019, right?
I guess.
2006.
Sure, dude. We'll go with that. All right. So this thing, you know, it was in a big sandstorm and stopped sending messages. But I guess the last message it sent supposedly said, like, it is getting very dark and my battery is running out or something weird like that. Like something strange. And I'm like, what? This is some weird shit. And then they made last contact and shut it down or whatever, or it just died, basically. And now everyone that was involved with it and all these NASA nerds and all these people are, like, emotionally impacted by the death of this machine. And it's strange to me. Like, I get it if you work with this thing and it provided you data, you know, oh, okay, like, that, you know, that sucks. We'll miss it, whatever. But people are, like, crying about it and I'm like, what? Like,
crying seems a little
yeah,
much.
Like, I'm so sad. Like, no, you're not, dude. It's just a robot. Like, fuck off.
I could see if you actually helped develop the thing and build it and you worked for years to, like, get this thing started. Like, you would have that, like, little sentimental feeling,
I guess,
of it being gone. Because, like, Andy was discussing, like, what happens if, like, he moves to another university or something like that. Not that he's going to do that. We were just discussing it. But a lot of those things that he bought in the lab were bought with university startup money, and it would have to stay. And if he moved, the whole Achilles rig would have to stay. We couldn't bring it. And I was like, oh, that would suck. Like, I spent so much time, like, putting this thing together. Like, I wouldn't want to just leave it behind. Yeah. And that's not even, like, as important or crazy as a Mars rover. So I could see the sentimental value a little bit if you directly work on it, but I can't see crying. Crying seems a little much.
I still, like, maybe a little bit, but part of me is just like, like, you knew this shit wasn't going to last forever anyways. Like, just hopefully you've been working on something new. Like, good riddance, man. Time to send something better. Yeah. Like, but there's like people posting like these paintings of, like, when we send people to Mars and they uncover the Opportunity rover. And they don't even call it Opportunity. They have a name for it. They call it, like, Opie or Oppie or something. And, like, how sad and how the humans will find this rover and pay their respects. I'm like, dude, like, you're creating, like, some kind of weird false AI machine god thing. Like, it's just a rover. Yeah. Like, get over it, man. Like, yeah, sure, we'll get it, we'll collect it, and we'll put it in a museum. But whatever. Yeah.
It is really weird that, like, we're sending these things there, and then, like, eventually they die, and now there's just this hunk of metal just sitting on Mars.
That's strange to think about. And I think it would be weird to, like, when you send people there and they go and find Mars, or Mars, they find the rover, and they're like, wow, like, this was, like, one of the first things that we sent here, and it's just, like, all fucked up in the sand or whatever.
Yeah. It's even weirder, though, how we just launch a bunch of crap and satellites and stuff into space, and, like, now there's just this massive debris cloud that, like, orbits the Earth all the time.
There's, like,
There's,
like, a map of that.
Seems so irresponsible. Yeah.
I would be worried.
That seems so irresponsible and crazy to me.
I'd be so, like, worried to send stuff into space. With all that debris floating around, like, it's going to get blasted.
Yeah,
by
they have
that.
To, like, time it right.
They probably do. They probably have, like, mathematical calculations on the best or lowest probability that you're going to run into some bullshit that flew off a spaceship 10 years ago.
Yeah, and there's still a slight chance that, it'll, like, some piece of metal will just shoot through the side of your craft, shoot through you.
Yeah. But I think that's how NASA, I mean, that's, from my understanding, that's how NASA does most of their stuff is, you know, they work with probabilities. Like, what's the lowest probability of, you know, whatever, death or contamination, that sort of stuff. So, I don't know, man. Space is weird.
Yeah. Understatement of the
space
year.
Space is strange, man.
But, yeah, it is crazy. I don't know why, but I'm one of those crazy people. Like, my whole life, I've thought of how awesome it would be to go to space.
I think about that all the time.
Yeah, I think most people, like, are like, no, that's crazy.
Dude, I get on, like, NASA's website, like, every few months. I'm like, do they have any astronaut openings? Or,
Dude, I think now more than ever, there's probably going to be more openings.
If they're going to start a good time sending more peoples out there, peoples.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about going to the moon by, like, what, 2020 or something like that, or 20...
I have no idea.
Like, as soon as possible. I don't know why we want to go to the moon. I guess we're thinking of creating, like,
a good base.
Like a refueling station or something like that, if we're going to start going farther into space.
It makes sense.
So I guess that kind of makes sense, but yeah, I mean, it's like, what else is there really to know about the moon? It's like, it's kind of a barren hunk.
Yeah, I don't
rock.
Even know what they already know about the moon other than that it's just, like, nothing. I don't know what research shows, like, what type of rocks. I have no idea.
I know I think has been shown that it's a hunk of the Earth. I think that's pretty
clear.
That's
what I thought. That's about all I could gather. So I don't know. I think there's plenty other interesting places we could go. I mean, I guess if you need a refueling place, that's cool, but there's a lot of interesting they call them worlds now, like worlds out there and even in our solar system, like other moons, like Europa, Enceladus, that have water and life for or energy for life. So I don't know, I guess it depends on what you or what, like, NASA or what the government really cares about trying to achieve with their space missions. But to me, I think the number one goal would be to just try and find life somewhere, some sort of life. But I don't know. Other people just want to make money, so whatever.
it's crazy to me, like, in these presidential administrations, like, you can never get, like, the perfect balance. Like, with Obama, it was like they did care about, like, climate science and stuff like that, and trying to curb emissions and stuff like that, but at the same time they were defunding NASA or reducing NASA funding and stuff like that. Now you have Trump, who's like the complete opposite, but now he's pumping more money into NASA. It's like, can we just get, like, the perfect balance here?
It,
like,
doesn't exist, man. But there is a lot of cool research going on. I don't know, it's weird. NASA just announced that they funded a bunch of different, or it's like three or four different what do they call it, biology and space things, where people are sending out on some, I guess, rockets or something, like seeds, fungus, algae, to see how, like, they react with radiation to try and infer how human cells and DNA repair would react.
Fungus will be fine. I already know.
Yeah, well, just put it in fungus a spore, and bacteria. Put it in a yeast. Be good.
Yeah. Fungus is fascinating.
I wish I knew more about it. But like in my research, and pretty much almost every microbial ecologist that I know, that because we look at like bacteria and maybe archaea,
yeah,
and sometimes they ignore the eukaryotes and stuff. But even if they do look at eukaryotes, they're looking at like algae. And if you ask them about fungus, they're just like, yeah, we know they're there, but we just kind of ignore them.
Yeah.
I don't know. It seems interesting. I don't know anything about them, obviously, because we ignore them. So who knows?
Speaking of ecology, I read my first two ecology papers. Our seminar started last week.
They were god awful.
It was awful. It's always awful when you jump into a new field of research when you're trying to like understand how they like organize their papers and like what's the terminology and like what are the techniques that they use. Like it's just a completely different world. And so like you're just like, and your job in a seminar is to like criticize the paper and break it down.
Oh,
but when
so
you
hard.
Like are just getting started and have no idea, you feel like an elementary school kid or
dude,
something like that.
It's
you're
the
like
worst.
Yeah, like I read it, like what's the main point of the article? Well, they did this basically, but beyond that, I don't know.
I do the same thing in my like geochem one. It's like, what do you guys gather from the spectra made by this FTIR and proton NMR? And I'm like, dude, I have no idea what I'm looking at. I just a graph with a bunch of lines. Like, dude, come on.
Yeah.
How about you tell me what it means?
Phylogenetic trees, is that what you call them?
Yep, that's it. When you have the different species or anything really coming down.
Like where they started and all their branching points, and you can see the different clades.
Yeah.
Those are fascinating, and I would love to know like how to make the obviously I know that they do like genetic sequencing and genetic analysis, and they try and reconstruct it somehow, but I'd like to know the details of like how they really reconstruct those. You guys have made some of those?
So they usually now they use some type of program, and they I can't remember, there's different methods of making these trees, and it depends on what gene you're looking at. Sometimes you can do like a whole genome comparison, but in bacteria and stuff we just use that 16S, you know, the ribosomal DNA
thing
or whatever. And what you do is you have whatever you're comparing. Say you're comparing 10 of these things, and you compare those to each other, and then you'll have like an out group that you know is like way out somewhere. Like you'll put like I don't even know what a good example is. A cyanobacteria way out, and then you'll have like a bunch of proteobacteria or something like that. And then it'll start to group them together based on those sequences and how closely related they are to each other.
And it's all based on probability, right?
Yeah.
Like they organize it in like the highest probability that this one's here and so
on. So they have this thing called bootstrapping where they basically the program just does it a number of times, like 100 times, and whatever happens the most, like that probability is where it comes out. So you'll see like in these trees they'll have these numbers next to where they branch off, like 0.88 or 0.99, and that's the percentage of times or the whatever that's where that tree limb falls, basically.
Yeah.
So it's strange and it gets weird. I don't really understand like how they do the space for time type thing where they're like, this is the distance relatedness back to their common ancestor.
So I learned about that. They do fossil calibration.
What in the
it's
world?
Like the coolest term for something ever. I was like, there's like, we had to fill out these knowledge forms when we were reading, and like one of my questions was like, what? So it's like positive aspects you have to write out, negative aspects, and then like three or four questions or something. So in my negative aspects was, they only used one fossil for fossil calibration, and then the next one of my questions is, what the hell is fossil calibration?
Yeah, what is that, dude? So, I've never even heard that.
Basically, what I determined was, so they were studying all these lizards in the Andes Mountains, and how the a term I had never known before, orogeny. I don't really know how to pronounce it, but it's basically mountain building. So, like, if you go back in history, the Andes weren't there, and eventually there was a time period where they call uplift, where the mountain actually started, based on plate tectonic stuff, the mountain actually started rising. And there were animals, there were those, a family, an ancestor of those lizards that were there at that time. Yeah. And they were studying the effect of altitude, and they call them, like, sky islands.
Sweet.
How that affects, like, basically the evolution of those lizards. And so, like, you can think of a mountain, and there's, like, going to be a bunch of peaks, and then, like, between the peaks, there's a bunch of valleys and stuff like that. So, like, if you are a sect of those lizards who just filled a niche at this high altitude peak or whatever, you're there at a very specific altitude, at a very specific temperature, and the weather's very specific, and what else is growing up there is very specific. So you can't easily then just come down and go to the other peak. So, like, there's, like, a group of lizards on one peak and a group of lizards on another peak who were related at one point, but now they've diverged and evolved to handle that climate in different ways. But they were trying to see, like, what was the pressure that caused a lot of this diversification or speciation or whatever. And so they did one of those phylogenetic trees, and then they had it laid out with a like a time scale underneath, like millions of years or whatever. And basically, they use certain fossils along the way to calibrate the time of the phylogenetic tree.
Weird.
So I don't know the exact specific techniques they use to do that, but that's, I think that's, they use fossils in some way and some dating techniques to calibrate that tree and align it with time throughout history.
Isotopes, maybe something like that, probably.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, something that I never do and have no idea about. So, but it's pretty cool, actually. It was. I had no great inputs though on the discussion when we were breaking down the papers, but hopefully I'll start catching on throughout the semester, and we'll get there.
Yeah,
but
it's hard, man. Like, my inputs are always based on, like, my knowledge background or something anyways. So it's, like, the paper might be about whatever. Like, for me right now, it's, like, dissolved organic matter in the deep ocean or some shit that I don't care about. So the only thing I know about dissolved organic matter is in, like, snow. So I have to, like, make these weird connections that even people in the class are like, like, what are you even talking about? I'm like, dude, I don't know. That's the only way I can connect the two. I have no idea.
Yeah. It was funny, though. Like, as we were discussing the paper and the professor's kind of explaining some of the stuff and what the figures mean, then I was able to actually start breaking things down. It was funny, like, people who were ecologists, like, that's their degree and that's the research they do, like, how they were, like, not catching some of the things. And I'm like,
right,
like, don't, like, I'm struggling over here, but, like, what are you doing? Like, I don't know, it always blows my
mind.
It'd
be, but, like, either they don't care, which could be an option, or they're just, like, more focused on, like, a certain part of the paper, like, how did they collect these samples or whatever the fuck, I don't know.
Yeah, it's crazy. But one thing I did learn is that, so there's, it's called ovipary or vivipary. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
It's in reptiles. Maybe they may, I think it's not even reptiles, certain mammals, but just the idea of whether you give birth by laying eggs and, like, depositing your eggs somewhere and taking care of those, or if your eggs are inside you and then you give birth to a live organism. So we talked about that, and I had no idea that lizards and, like, snakes and reptiles and stuff can get, like, have vivipary, give birth to live Oregon. I thought they all laid eggs.
I thought they did, too. Like, I had no idea. I'm really confused right now.
But that's not the case. That's not the case. So there's a few different evolutionary pressures that can determine whether or not you're going to deposit your eggs somewhere else and like take care of them that way, or keep your eggs inside you. And part of it's predation. So if you're more likely to die yourself, like it's better to put your eggs somewhere else, so that way your offspring has a higher chance of making it. If you are like, I guess, like pit vipers and like poisonous snakes, they're not as in danger of being eaten by some predator, so it's okay for their eggs to be inside them and then actually give birth to like a live snake or whatever. So that's one thing. The other thing is temperature. If there's a colder temperature, so those lizards that were at high altitude, there was way more of those lizards did vivipary, gave birth to live organisms, because then they could behaviorally regulate the temperature of their babies. They could like move their babies with them, get out in the sun, come back or whatever. So
that's weird. I had no idea that was a thing. I thought they all just laid eggs, man.
I know. Me too.
I thought that was like a defining characteristic of mammals.
Yeah. Well, see, there's also mammals that, so like platypuses.
Oh, those, everyone knows those don't count. Those things are weird.
they lay eggs. So there's always these weird, like we think we, like mammals are this and reptiles are this, but there's always these weird like evolutionary differences and exceptions in each category. So I should have known that it's possible, but I never thought about it.
I never even considered it. I mean, I guess it makes sense, but who knows, dude? I don't know.
So I guess, you know, I went into the semester like, oh, I got to take this ecology biodiversity stupid seminar. But I guess there's always something cool and interesting you can learn from anything. So
that's what I was telling a guy the other day. I was like, man, I just had to read like six papers for this one seminar class. And he's like, oh, that sucks. I'm like, yeah, it kind of sucks, but you know, I'm learning a lot of things I never thought about before. He's like, sure you are. I'm like, dude, it's like I'm trying to rationalize this class, all right, man? But really, I do learn a lot from the class. So how applicable it is, I don't know, but it's nice to have like another, even if it's just like a group of people talking about some different subject, it's nice to be a part of that, just to be there to figure some shit
out. And I think it's cool, like if you're just always in your lab focused on your stuff, you're probably not ever going to learn any new techniques or possibilities. And you never know when you might run into something where one of those techniques might be useful. And you're like, you would have, if you didn't ever know about it, you wouldn't know of the possibility of being able to do it. But if you like, you're like, oh, wait, I've heard about this. Like I can think of something like that. So it can come in handy. Like for instance, in my lab with the new stuff that I'm doing, we're getting to a point where we think we could start looking for an actual cellular mechanism. So we're going to be going down the molecular route pretty soon.
Sweet.
And there was like one technique that we might need to be able to use that we're not set up for. And like, because I've taken some seminars, I was like, oh, I know a professor who does this stuff.
Right,
like,
right.
So like that kind of stuff can be helpful too. Like just knowing someone who knows these techniques.
I just ran into a similar thing. Like, so I sent you that picture of this, I don't know, this weird carbon isotope tracking experiment that I've been thinking about. But I got to a point where I was like I feel like I read a paper or went to a seminar where someone did something about this. And then like I figured out who it was and the paper where it came from. And it's like, oh, so that's why I have to go to these things, because sometimes they're helpful. Okay, got it. you run into those problems, or those, well, not problems, but you run into those times where it's nice to know or network or, you know, be able to reach outside your field a little bit to be like, oh, yeah, that's a good technique. Maybe I'll think about that later.
Yeah. That's one of the number one things I think with science is collaborating with other people.
Like, oh, for sure.
If you're just isolated doing your own thing, like, you might get some stuff done, but you're going to be able to do so much more by having this network of people that know all these cool techniques or know way more about one topic than you know about.
Yeah, you'll be able to answer the bigger questions. So, like, if you're a microbiologist, you can do some micro stuff and learn a little bit. But if you know some big picture, like mathematical modelers or some engineers, and then you can start designing different experiments to answer the bigger questions and get after them that fit your experiments. Like, your small portion makes a bigger part of the whole. Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's like... two heads are better than one. 100 are better than five. So,
yeah,
it scales.
Yeah, it does for sure. No, it makes sense, man. Like, I don't know. I enjoy having collaborations because it just gives you that possibility of, I don't know. Everyone thinks about stuff differently, especially if they're from different fields. Yeah. So it's helpful.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So we talked about last week how this week was either going to be my dream crusher or give me some more hope. And we joked about, like, if we graphed my hopes and dreams on a chart, it pretty much looks like a Bitcoin stock market graph.
Up, down, up, down, up, down.
Yeah, so this week I went in and I it was the big week. I was going to do HD experiments, ex vivo in the dish at physiological temperature.
Yeah.
And we didn't see, like, so we got the in vivo data and we've got the ex vivo data. We were really hoping that what happens in vivo that's so revolutionary and crazy would happen exactly in the dish.
Right.
And of course, that's not exactly what happened. It's never just easy and cut and dry like that.
No.
But we did get some good preliminary data that is promising. Like, it's not everything we hoped for, but it was better than just Dream Crusher. So
that's good.
That was good. So I'm back on track, and we are seeing very similar stuff to what we're seeing in vivo.
Yeah.
And I think I have a good explanation for the minor differences.
Oh, good.
So like I said, now there's one more hurdle to get past, and I'll figure that out on Monday. But if that checks out, then I think we have some really solid stuff that we can actually start, like, digging into and, like I said, figuring out, like, a cellular mechanism. but the big thing is, so in science, you always have to do your controls.
Right.
So, you know, you're always excited about studying, like, for us, it's, we have a disease model, so we want to study the HD and see what's happening. But you have to do, the wild types are just as important, because if you look at something right. and see it, it might be technique related or something like that. So you got to look at wild type to see if you see normal behavior or if you see the same difference that you noticed. So big thing I got to do is the exact same experiment in wild type to make sure, like, just based on what I'm doing, the cells right. aren't just dying because of that. So
right now the graph is still going up, but it could
come way down again.
Yeah. Did you?
So
Steve texted me earlier in the week. You text me and you're like, "It happened in the dish." It was just like a random text, and I was like, "What the fuck is he talking about?" Yeah. Like, is this like a song? What are we talking? Then it like occurred to me. I was like, "Oh, yeah, that's right. The dish experiment. Yeah. I got it.
Yeah. But yeah, so I think what happened this week happening in the dish is much less likely than wild type being normal. So it's less of a worrying thing, but there is still that possibility right. that it could not go so well. So we just got to do the experiment and hope for the best. But it's at least the chances that HD was going to do what it did in vivo in the dish were so, like, minuscule that I was not very excited about it.
Sure.
And I was super worried about doing the experiment.
Yeah.
But I'm much more comfortable with what's going to happen with wild type. So
yeah, not as
so hopefully it goes well.
You have a pretty good expectation of what will happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it's interesting. There's like doing it in vivo and based on what happened there, I was like, almost 100% certain based on what I read in the literature that it was, you know, these select few cellular mechanisms is probably what's happening. And we collaborate with another muscle physiologist, Dr. Rich, and he's super into this idea of periodic paralysis and inexcitable cells with these neurodegenerative disorders and stuff like that. So he wanted to take some of my cells after my experiment and do some EFIS on them and see if the muscles are actually still alive or if they're just totally dead, or maybe the reason we're not getting the force is because of something related to this periodic paralysis thing. Based on the in vivo data, I was like, oh, this dude's just holding out hope for nothing. Like, he just is just hoping to get something cool, but it's not going to happen. Like, it's this other mechanism. But based on what I saw in the dish, there's actually a lot more chances that it could be what he's hoping. So I'm actually excited to see that data too. But what's really cool about something like this is like all of the doors it opens up.
Yeah.
Like the questions, like it's like you answer one question, 10 other questions,
right?
You know, come up from that. But there's a whole lot of projects now.
That's sweet.
That we could go and do based on this new stuff.
I love that, but I also hate it because there's never enough time, and you want to do it all, I know. But you just can't. So you have to like pick a portion of it, and it's just like, ugh.
I know, and I've already done way more like work than a typical master's degree would do.
Yep.
And now that I've gotten to this point, I'm like, oh, I want to do at least 5 of these other things.
They're like, dude,
and it's like, that's
might as well just stay for your PhD now. Like,
yeah. Yeah. So, but on the other hand, if the only medical school I get into is Wright State,
yeah,
I already have like incredible PhD projects waiting for me. So that's
so
one
just roll right into
benefit.
It.
So, yeah. That is going to be the hard thing, though. Like, if I do go somewhere else, it's going to be awesome because we want to get out of Ohio, number one.
What? Ohio.
But if we do get out, like, I'm going to have to go into a completely new lab, and maybe I'll get into EPHYS again or some kind of physiology lab where similar techniques will be going on, but it'll be totally new project. Going to have to dive into a whole bunch of new papers and, like, figure it out from the ground up again.
That's weird. Like, I never really thought about that. Like, so when I left my undergrad lab and came to my PhD lab, I was done pretty much with my work anyways, and we're writing it up at that point.
Yeah.
So it didn't really matter. So I just kind of transitioned right into it. But, and plus I liked it, but I wasn't in love with it either. I just kind of did it. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. That's a weird thing. That is going to be weird because you put a lot of effort, dude, into that, your Achilles thing, all that stuff, and you're just going to be like, peace out, going to go check out some other shit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. But, like, even still, like, so I don't know how this – I think you would still get recognition, but, like, say we did all this work, like, whatever you're doing or whatever I'm doing, we're working under a PI in a lab under their direction – but like, say you like followed the research, you came up with this cool idea, and then you discovered something really amazing.
Yeah.
Probably what's going to happen is your PI is going to get most of the recognition for that.
Like, yeah.
They'll probably, obviously, if they're a good PI, they're going to bring you along and like give you accolades and stuff like that. And it's going to help your resume to have that breakthrough paper on there. But like, you're not going to be the guy getting all of the like recognition.
I mean, it'll help because like when they bring people in from other universities to talk, they'll add in like, hey, this person published in Nature in their PhD program. And you're like, oh, okay. But it probably helps the PI's lab more than it. I mean, I'm sure it helps both, but I bet the PI lab gets a pretty good bump from that.
Oh, yeah. So it's interesting, all of those things. It's like, also, like, you know, I don't think I'm anywhere close to this, or nor do I necessarily have big dreams and hopes that it's ever going to happen. But like, if you did something that led to like a Nobel Prize type of a thing, like, do you get part of that as being one of the leading students doing that research, or is it all your PI that gets that, or like, how's that work?
I don't know. I guess it would depend on the PI and how cool the PI is. If they're like, we did it together, or this was my idea, you just did the work, or if it was your idea and you did the work. I guess, I don't know, we talk about this in writing papers a lot, is how do you set up who is a part of the paper and who's not? Like, just because someone was there and helped you pour media once, that doesn't mean they're in the paper. Or, you know, like, who what order is the author list of the paper based on these things?
Yeah.
I don't know. It gets weird. And other fields do it different ways. So, like, in biology, or at least micro, the person who did the most work is the first author. And then the PI is the last person on the list. But in engineering, it's just, like, alphabetical order. It's, like, it gets weird. So, I don't know. I don't know how to go about doing those things or how that
Yeah, it's interesting. And there's also, like, when you're writing papers, like, if you're looking at, like, say you're assessing somebody, like you're a PI at this point, and you're like looking at candidates and you're looking at their resume of papers or whatever.
Yeah.
And there's one person who's got all these papers, but all the papers have like 50 authors on it.
Yeah. It's like,
but then you've got another guy that's got like 10 papers and it's like four authors here, five authors there, and they're first on most of them. You're like, the one with 50 authors, it's like, how much work did this guy actually do?
Yeah.
For each of these papers,
did they just contribute by like making a figure? Yeah. Did they write any? Like, or was there just a conference call they're part of? Like, I don't know. My PI runs into stuff,
but I
like
think
that
that's
because she's so collaborative. Some of these papers come out with like 15 people on it. It's just like, okay, well,
yeah.
How much does that really matter?
I think that helps though when you've got like, that's why they do like recommendation letters and stuff like that. And that's the opportunity for like your PI to be like, this guy really put a lot of work into it, and like this is their work ethic and blah 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 blah. So there's like a combination of things that have to go into it. One of the things Andy always talks about is one of the best like things that you could do to get on a bunch of papers is to be like a stats guy or something like that. Like,
oh, for sure.
Those guys can like pump out all kinds of papers throughout a year, 'cause they're just taking other people. Like, they don't have to do experiments. They're just taking other people's data.
Yeah.
Cranking out the analysis and then sending it back, and boom, they've got a paper.
Yeah.
That's
a good way to do it.
That's not going to be me.
No, not
but
me either, but it does make sense. I like, I don't know. I like when I get my data, I mess with it to try and figure it out on my own. And sometimes maybe it would be easier to send it to other people, but my PI would probably never let me do that anyways. So
yeah, no. It's super beneficial. Even if you're slow and inefficient, it's super beneficial for you to like figure it out. And like, the more you do it, the better you're going
to
get.
At some point, you're probably going to be asked to explain your data, so I would hope you know how it works.
It's pretty exciting. I'm excited to, now that some of these things have checked out in the dish, I'm much more amped up to do the work. Like, after initially in the dish, we did the initial one in the other group's lab, and it didn't go so well. And we were like, after that, I was like, I don't even want to like work on this project anymore. Like, everything we're doing is like not real. Right. But then after we went, you didn't give up, and we tested out the temperature idea, and that checked out. So now I'm like,
nice.
I've got more energy to put into the work. It's much more easy to get yourself to do something that's got a chance of, you know, something real happening. And then the other option is like you're working on something that just isn't going to work. It's not very easy to get motivated for that.
Yeah. I think a lot of people that do, I don't know, I guess maybe your field, or like I think of like people that study pathogens and stuff like that. A lot of their stuff is based on molecular work, testing these ideas out. And I think a lot of the time they have these ideas, they test them out, and it doesn't work or whatever. So there's a lot of, I don't know if I'd say wasted time, but there's a lot of dead time, I guess, where you put a lot of effort into stuff and it doesn't work out. Like, my field is much more like you can go out to the field and sample some stuff, and whatever you get, you can make some conclusions from. So it's really not too life or death, but other fields is much more that way.
Yeah, I mean, because some of these questions are hard to answer, and it's the techniques are not easy, and the experiment takes a full day, and you need a bunch of the experiments added up to start answering the questions. Right. And it's like, you can waste a whole year on something, you get to the end and it's like, oh no, that's not the case.
I have a friend like here that wasted a whole, I think, 2 or 3 years on a project that just got nowhere. Just everything didn't work.
Yeah.
I'm like, dang, dude.
That's awful. And then you don't get anything really on your resume for that.
Like, no one cares if you didn't find out something. I guess you can write up stuff like that. It's but
it's not this.
Yeah.
Hey guys, I figured out it's not this.
We're like, okay, thanks. I guess we won't try that. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough though. And we've discussed that in the lab before. Like, you can have two people doing the same quality of work, but one person's working on something that pans out and the other person's working on something that just doesn't.
Yeah.
And this person's now dead in the water and this one's on their way to an awesome career. It's not always fair. Science but that's just life, right?
Yeah,
life's
not sometimes
always
you
fair.
Get lucky.
Yeah.
Can you imagine being the other guy? I don't have any experience with either side of those, so I'm just neutral.
Yeah.
But like being the guy that tried so hard, didn't work, and then you read a paper when someone did the exact same thing and it worked, you're like, what the fuck?
Like in a different model or something like that.
You're like, how the hell?
They're on the cover of some magazine or something.
Like,
you're like, oh man.
Doing interviews on Joe Rogan and shit or something. You're like, how did this happen? Why?
Yeah. Yeah, it's rough. But you can't control that though. So you just gotta keep on moving and try the next thing.
Yep.
That's the number one thing. I think science and just life in a lot of aspects is like just this test of your will and perseverance. Like, you just got it. Like, if something doesn't go your way, like, you can sit there and sulk about it and like, you know, give up and be miserable for the rest of your life, or you can just take your lessons from that, brush yourself off and go on and try the next thing.
I mean, that's all you can do, really. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how you wouldn't, but I mean, I've seen plenty of people that when they lose, they take that loss pretty hard instead of just being like, oh, fuck it, next thing, you know? So,
yeah.
Yeah, dude.
So, yeah. But I think that's pretty much it for this episode of the Beak Report. Do you have do you have anything else to add before we take off this week? Or?
I could complain about a lot of stuff, but...
Oh, yeah, complaining's our forte, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, but we don't have to get into that because it'll probably make a lot of people mad, so we'll avoid those.
Yeah, we'll just save those for the text messages.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, well, I think that sums it up for this week. As always, check out the social media stuff. We're at the Beaker Report, and... We'll be back next week.
We'll be here.
Boom.
Where's the rockets?
All right. Oh, I missed it. I missed the landing.